Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
But had I not had that career disappointment of losing the job that I thought I wanted so bad, I would have never made Admiral. You know, I would have never even probably made Captain. I would have gone to that other job and probably just kind of had a middle-level career, you know what I mean? And so I think sometimes we have to really be mindful and open to whatever's coming our way. Be a little Semper Gumby, a little flexible, and leap at that opportunity that we just wouldn't have seen or didn't see because we were so blind to everything we thought we wanted. We live in a fragile democracy, as we've seen over the last year, right? As strong as our Constitution is to have survived and thrived over 200 plus years, we need people to make sure that that happens and stays that way so that our kids always have the freedoms we did growing up and that our nation perseveres. You know, as a leader, you have to look for those opportunities that are transformational, that will change something for the better, the mission, the people, the business of your business, right? And if you don't look to those opportunities to change things, then you might be successful for a while, but you know, you don't want to end up being Sears in an Amazon world.
This podcast is sponsored by Nyla Technology Solutions, an SBA-certified 8A, HubZone, woman-owned small business specializing in full-stack software engineering and data science services to the U.S. government. Our innovative solutions are built to match the speed of mission. For more information, partnering opportunities, and new job openings, please visit our website, www.nyla.io. Good morning, Danelle Barrett, with two L's, two R's, and two T's. Tell me where you are this morning. I know you're kind of a jet setter. Where are you right now?
This is one of the first times I've traveled in the last, year because of COVID. So I'm in San Diego now in Coronado. So I'm being a spoiled little rich kid, getting to rent a place in Coronado for 2 weeks while I'm doing some work for the Navy. So it's very, very nice. I'm very spoiled.
Tell us about your current day job or your gigs. I think it's less of a day job and more like gigs.
Yeah, it's sort of a Chinese menu of fun is what I would like to say. I wrote a book recently, which is coming out next month, which I'm pretty excited about. And I do consulting for cybersecurity and digital transformation, you know, like cloud technology and modernization and things like that. And I do public speaking. And for fun, I'm an extra in movies and TV and stuff like that. I sign up for those kind of little gigs like once a month or so. And you go and you be dumpy lady crossing street number two. That's like a role I've been preparing for my whole life, right out of central casting. So it's all good.
We'll delve into it further, but what is the name of your book?
The book is called Rock the Boat. It's basically like having a conversation with your mentor. It's really meant to be not a heavy tome. You're not going to kill any brain cells reading it, but it's practical, common sense advice for a mentor and a mentee to have over a cup of coffee. You know, like, you know, how you deal with jerks, you know, how you do your home work-life balance, how you communicate, you know, how you motivate people, just all those kind of general leadership things that we learn as and pick up as we go from other great leaders that we work with.
And what is the name of your business?
It's called Cybersecure at Sea. It's just an LLC, and that's kind of what I do my consulting under. And I sit some corporate boards too, so anything that I do kind of falls under that LLC name.
How many boards are you on?
I'm currently on three boards, two banks and one company that sells maritime communication systems and navigation systems.
Are they all publicly traded companies?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what is it like to be on a board? How much time is involved?
Well, there's a significant amount of time dependent upon what's going on. So a lot of times boards, you know, they say, well, they only meet four times a year. Well, that's true. But in between there, you're doing advice for different committees on the board. You may sit, like, for example, I sit on one board, a technology committee and a strategy committee, or you may be on an audit committee or something like that. And obviously before the board, you have a big board book that arrives either electronically or in paper that takes several days to read through and understand what's going on. And for me, two of the boards that I'm on our banks, like I said, and that's an industry I was completely unfamiliar with. And so I had to spend a lot of time with folks in that industry and in the company to really understand the business of the business, because I want to do well and contribute. And a lot of the skills that I bring are cybersecurity related. And they're also in the military, you do a lot of risk management, you do a lot of accountability and those kind of things. And so those are the general leadership things that they look for in board members as well.
I know there's several programs to prepare women for boards. Were you part of that or did you just leap right into it after you left the Navy?
Yeah, no, I leaped right into it. I mean, I kind of figure, there are some certification programs out there and I'm sure they're good. I did one course called Battlefield to Boardroom, which kind of just teaches you how to get a board job and what board members do, that kind of thing. But I kind of felt like just getting in and understanding that organization was more important than a general board program, certification program, understanding what the needs were of that organization and its shareholders and making sure I could do that well. And so I felt my time was better spent individually knowing the companies that I was supporting.
Now, did you start with one or three all at once?
Oh, no. And it started with one. And then over the course of about 6 months after that, I picked up the other two. And I'm very blessed. I'll be honest with you. It's quite a challenge to get board jobs a lot of times. And it's a little bit of a racket. I mean, because there's no, you know, one sort of central place where you can go look for board jobs or let people know you're looking for board jobs. The reality is you usually get referred by somebody else or somebody says, hey, this person would really be a good fit for your board personality wise and skills wise and that kind of thing. And so I was just really, really fortunate that some people were looking out for me and looking for opportunities and then passing them my way when they got it.
How long has it been since you officially retired from the Navy?
I retired in December of 2019.
Okay, so right before the pandemic. What did you think that year was going to be like for you?
It's funny because I planned to work from home anyway. When I retired from the Navy, I moved back to Buffalo, kind of be closer to family. That's where I grew up and my family is. But what I planned to do was work from home, basically. Any good cybersecurity company kind of doesn't care where your fanny sits, you know, even pre-pandemic. So those are the kind of companies you want to work with. And as long as you're within close distance to an airport that you can get to, you know, within 30 minutes or something, it kind of doesn't matter anymore where you sit. And even more so now we've found out during COVID that that absolutely is true.
Tell us about your last position with the Navy. What were you doing?
Yeah, so my last position, I was working in the soul-crushing Pentagon. And so I was director of Navy cybersecurity, doing a lot of policy and making sure the right things got funded for the next 4 or 5 years in the Navy with regard to cybersecurity and information technology. And I was also the Navy's deputy CIO, chief information officer.
How does a young woman with a degree in arts end up being deputy CIO of the Navy?
I know. Is that crazy or what? I mean, you know, the things the Navy will teach you that you never expected you'd ever learn. It's awesome. When I got in, I had a history degree from Boston University and I couldn't program my VCR. Now I can program a router. So there you go. But it turned out that my sole career objective when I got in was to live someplace warm. And so
you're living your dream in Buffalo.
Living my dream in Buffalo. It was really cold. And then I went to school in Boston. So I'm not getting any, you know, suntan at either of those places, right? And so when they were like, hey, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I just want to live someplace warm. I don't even care what the job is. You know what I mean? And so the first job I got sent to was in Jacksonville, Florida, a Navy communications station. And I got in that job and I found that I really enjoyed it. I was never like a tech nerd or anything like that. I certainly am now, you know, but I never was. And I used to do a lot of arts and theater and painting and, you know, just like all that kind of stuff, that side of the brain. When I got in the Navy, it was really fun because you could do technology and the jobs in technology were really good because they were always really big leadership jobs. You know, you could be 22 years old and have 100 people working for you and a budget of, you know, I don't know, $1 million that you're responsible for right out of the gate. So I found that if you stayed in the technology side of the Navy, like communications, you could get big leadership jobs and do technology. And so it was a win-win.
So you came to this realization within the first year of being in the Navy. How quick did you kind of make this pivot and decision?
Yeah, it was like within the first year because I had good mentors there too at my first job who said, hey, you know, you picked a good one here. I'm like, well, gosh, I didn't pick a good one. Serendipity and people were looking out for me. That's what happened. You know what I mean? I was just a dumb ensign who wanted to get a tan, right? So, and then when I got there too, then they helped me see that it was a whole career option, you know, not just a job, but you could continue to do that function for a long time, you know, communications. And at that time, when I first got in, we were just starting to get computers. And so it was the middle of 1989. So we started getting networks in the early 90s and then the job changed significantly. It was great, you know, because then you get into all the whole cyber side as the years went by.
You've been living through the evolution of these systems, right? Starting with people barely had home computers to now every single person has this unbelievably powerful device and just their phone.
It's amazing when you think about, you know, where they went to the moon with 64 kilobits of memory or something. Now you have that in the, you know, a little RFID tag on your credit card or something. I mean, it's crazy to think about how technology has been exponentially accelerating, converging, and providing us opportunities, but also risk. You know, we have to be careful there too. There's a little bit of both.
Now, what were some of the real pivot points after that first year that you found yourself in your career that were really critical to either going up a ladder or zigging and zagging up into bigger leadership strategic roles?
Serendipity helps there. And you always have to be mindful of that window that's just open to you that when a door closes. So the biggest career disappointments I ever had turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me, although they feel really crushing at the moment, you know, that you're like, oh my God, that I can't believe that happened. A perfect example was I was a job that I was going to that required a super high security clearance. At first, people were like, oh, well, my husband's from South America, so I have foreign in-laws. And they're like, oh, well, if you got foreign in-laws, that's going to be a non-starter. You know, you can get all these, you know, high security clearances, but not that one, right? And so I was like, oh, man. So, but they were like, oh, no, we'll get you a waiver. You know, we'll be able to get you a waiver. We really want you in. So it turns out they couldn't get me the waiver. And about 2 weeks before I was supposed to report, that process ground away for like a year. And about 2 weeks before I was supposed to report to that job, they call me up. They're like, hey, sorry, we couldn't get the waiver. And you know, go find something else, basically. And I was like, oh my God, I have 2 weeks now to try to figure out what's a great career option. What should I be doing next? And at the time, they had just opened up sea duty to women. So I called my detailer, who's the person who kind of finds you your jobs and assigns you your jobs. And I said, hey, look, I want to go to sea. And they at the time said, oh, well, we have this job. And the job was actually a pretty crappy job. I was like, let me call you back. Right. So I called around and found out a job that was opening that was really good at sea and stuff like that. And then I had them call the detailer and say, hey, we would really like this person. And the detailer agreed. And so then they wrote me the orders there. And the thing that happened at that job is I worked for an individual, a man who's my mentor today, a wonderful man. And he then subsequently, after I worked for him there, brought me along to other opportunities for years after that. But had I not had that career disappointment of losing the job that I thought I wanted so bad, that was the best job for me, you know, there's nothing else on my radar. If I hadn't lost that opportunity, I would have never made admiral. You know, I would have never even probably made captain. I would have gone to that other job and probably just kind of had a middle level career. You know what I mean? And so I think sometimes we have to really be mindful and open to whatever's coming our way. Be a little Semper Gumby, a little flexible, and leap at that opportunity that we just wouldn't have seen or didn't see because we were so blind to everything we thought we wanted.
What year is this that they opened up allowing women to go to sea for the first time?
I can't remember exactly, but I want to say it was probably 96, 98, right around there.
What kind of ship did you go on?
It was on what was called an LCC. It's a communications ship for a big staff. So for example, it was the second fleet staff at the time, which is the three-star admiral who would control everything that was happening in the Atlantic, basically, operationally, the ships and the aircraft and stuff like that. That would have been his ship, his flagship, they call it, for when he'd have to go out to sea and do things. So there's two of those. There's one in Yokosuka, Japan called the Blue Ridge that the 7th Fleet rides. And then there's another one in Naples, Italy.
So it's like a massive telecommunications center.
Yeah, it's basically a big command and control ship. So it's not a ship that's going to fire weapons or launch aircraft or things like that. Those are carriers and destroyers and other combatant ships. This is a combatant ship, but it's not one that would, you know, you'd be with other ships that would do those things, but you'd be the one sort of in charge and your boss would be in charge of all that. So on that ship, I was responsible for like the networks and things like that for the staff that was on there. And there was probably like 500 people on the crew of the ship and then 200 people on the staff, maybe of the admiral staff.
So you were like, did you try rebooting it?
Oh yeah. Hey, is your tongue stuck in the keyboard? Let's move that. The problem is between the chair and the keyboard. It's not the network. Let's work on that a little bit, right?
So how many years have you been in the Navy before you finally go to sea?
So I went to sea it first time in 98 and I got in 89. So, you know, I don't do a lot of public math, but about 9 years.
And you're what level officer at this time?
So I was a lieutenant, a senior lieutenant.
What percentage of women were on the ship?
Ooh, not many. I could count them probably on two hands, you know what I mean? On the staff, there was only me and one other person, I think. And, you know, that's not unusual because I took a lot of operational jobs, which I loved, you know. So some of it was like I deploy in the field with communications gear, mobile units and things like that. And a lot of times you're like the only woman or you're the only woman in the room. And that's just something you get used to. You don't even notice it anymore, honestly. And I grew up with three brothers. So for me, you know, I never thought it was a big issue, you know. And I do remember, though, it's a bigger issue to other people than it was to me. I remember being in the Navy Exchange one time, like years later, like, I don't know, 2010 or something. And some guy comes up to me. He's like, hey, were you on an exercise in Qatar back in like 1996? And I'm thinking back, I'm like, holy cow. I'm like, yeah, I guess I was. I said, holy cow, you must remember who bags your groceries. He's like, oh, no, you were the only woman on the camp. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I didn't realize I was the only woman on the camp. But so, you know, other people remember when it's long off your radar, right?
Were you married at the time?
Yeah. Yeah, I got married like right out of college. My college sweetheart.
Oh, you met him at Boston U?
I did. Yeah, he was working up there and I was going to school. And he's just a wonderful, he's a saint. So I'm just blessed to have him along on the ride with me.
Did he go into the Navy as well?
He did not, but he worked for years for the government, for the Navy, a lot of times as a physical therapy assistant at Navy medical centers and hospitals.
That's a really needed job.
Oh, yeah. And then recently, in the last 5 years, he retired and he's actually a Reiki master now. And he used to do free Reiki for people with post-traumatic stress disorder at Walter Reed and VA hospital. So Reiki's sort of like tapping into your inner energy to find other ways for peaceful life as opposed to just medicating people. You know, that's what they're looking for, alternative ways for people to cope with that kind of stress, particularly combat stress. So he does that as a volunteer now and at the VA hospital.
And how old were you when you had your daughter?
I was 29.
So is this right before or after you go on the ship?
It was right before, and it was, I was actually stationed in Bahrain. It was funny because the hospital was great. The care was great and everything. But when she was born, she looked like every other baby over there, you know. And so I said to my husband, like, go take a Sharpie and write her name on the bottom of her foot because, like, I just want to make sure I get my kid back, right? Because she looked like every other, dark hair, dark brown eyes. I mean, she's just a little peanut, but she looked like every other baby over there. And so we made sure that, you know, we brought our kid home.
What did your parents think of this? Of this whole career in the Navy and having a daughter in Bahrain, was this you were in the family way or were they kind of shocked by your adventures?
I don't think shocked because I've always kind of been that way, independent and kind of adventurous and stuff like that. I don't think they were shocked. I think they're very proud of me the whole time. And they've always been super supportive. I mean, my mom and dad show up for all sorts of things, you know, and my stepdad show up for all sorts of things, you know, military ceremonies and events. And every time there was a move, my mom and my stepdad would show up and help us with the move and stuff like that. And, you know, I had a grandfather who was in the Army, but no, and he died way before I was even born. So there was no kind of military connection. And in Buffalo, there's certainly not a lot of Navy connection. So it was a little surprise to them, I think, but they were incredibly supportive the whole way.
Did your brothers go in any service?
Nope, just me.
And where do you fall in the lineup?
I'm smack in the middle. I'm total middle child and all the stereotypes that go along with that, you know. And like I said, I grew up with three brothers. So it was actually great training for the Navy because someone's like always shanking somebody on the playground or shooting somebody in the head with a BB gun. You learn how to fend for yourself. You know what I'm saying? When you got three brothers.
And how do your brothers pronounce your name?
I always joke about it, but they always say Darnell, right? Because my name is a little unusual. There's no I in it. And so people call me Darnell and Danielle and whatever. So I just tell them, hey, just call me Donnell and you'll remember.
As a Shayna, I have people always struggling with how to pronounce it. I'm on a new team and I said, it's Shayna like Dana, not Shanna like banana.
That's good. That's a good way to remember
it. That's stuck in their heads.
Totally. Yeah, you got to do that. Otherwise, you're going to be called everything. Sharna and Shola and, you know.
How long were you on the ship for?
That first tour on the Mount Whitney was 2 years.
And how old is your baby at this time?
3, going on 4, about that.
Did you take the job because, you know, that was the only job available at the time? Or what were your thoughts on being separated from your daughter for periods of time?
Well, we knew that was going to be the case because even in Bahrain, even though it was shore-based, 6 weeks after I had her, I went back to work. And I remember we had these really crappy trailers we were working in, and there was something going on with, I think it was Iran at the time. And so they had ramped up this watch, and I was standing watches at night. And so I was expressing milk in the trailer. I just shut the door in the trailer and express milk and then throw it in this little crappy fridge. And the next morning, somebody comes in and they were like, Yeah, I was just eating cereal and that milk in the fridge it's like the milk in the fridge is sour. I'm like, dude, that was the milk for my daughter. And he was like, I'm like, hey, don't drink other people's milk, right?
It's so good for the skin though.
So I was like one of two women on the whole staff or whatever. And so he was like practically throwing up. I'm like, yeah, okay, that's your lesson learned for eating other people's food out of the fridge. Just don't do that again, right? And by the way, my daughter's going hungry today. Thanks a lot.
Did you ever consider quitting? I mean, it was pretty unusual, I think, at that time, not only to be a full-time working woman, but to take jobs similar to yours. Were you ever questioning your path?
No, I didn't, because I wanted to serve. We live in a fragile democracy, as we've seen over the last year, right? And as strong as it is, as strong as our Constitution is, to have survived and thrived over 200 plus years, we need people to make sure that that happens and stays that way so that our kids always have the freedoms we did growing up and that our nation perseveres. And so I always felt a real sense of purpose to do that. And I'll tell you, you know, when you say the oath, it's a really inspiring thing. I love to give the oath when you re-enlist enlisted or other folks, other officers. And I love to say it myself, you know, when I had the opportunity to advance to the next rank. And I say, I support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I mean, those words you take to heart, right? And so I never wanted to do anything else. I just felt it was really important work. Now, it's hard to be away from your family, and that totally is terrible. And I hated that part being away. But when you are on an operational job, you're so focused on the mission and the operations, and your days are so long, and you just power through. And there's a great sense of job satisfaction. And that's the only thing that offsets being away from your family, which is the worst part about being in the military.
I've worked a lot of operational systems. I liken it to being in an emergency room. It's kind of always intense. If it's calm, you might be cleaning up or planning, but it's always very, very active and engaged all day long, which is very different from really strategic planning or development, which can be kicked out or kicked down the road with operations. It's very real, very immediate, real support, clearly people on the other end. It's a real night and day between operations and pure development without a crisis of like, you're in war and the system has to get out. Now, did your mother work?
Not when I was real little, but my mom was a nurse before she had us. And then she probably, when I was about a teenager, maybe, she went back to work as a she will kill me if I say this wrong, not an industrial health nurse, but a Ford plant and a chemical company. I can't remember what the name
is. Like the school nurse for a big company or factory.
Yeah, it is. And they're super, like, she got her master's degree, and they're super smart in like OSHA standards and, you know, compensation claims and those kind of things that it used to be called industrial health nursing, but it's called something else now. And she's going to kill me for not remembering the name of it.
We'll get it right in the show notes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. There's a name for it. I just can't remember off the top of my head.
Is she still working?
No, she's retired now. But it's funny. My mom's 78, and she's the kind of woman, she's always inspired me because she's the kind of woman who doesn't focus on being a woman. She just does stuff, right? And so, like, if I need PVC pipe laid in my front yard, I'm calling my 78-year-old mother because she'll go out and do it. You know what I mean? She's just that kind of gal to this day. You know, she still plays tennis 4 times a week. She, you know, if something needs to be fixed, she's out there YouTubing it. And you know, there's even a funny story. Like, I had this real antique lamp, or like one of those old gooseneck lamps and stuff, and it never worked once since I bought it, but I bought it because it was beautiful. And she's like, hey, your lamp doesn't work. I'm like, yeah, I know, Mom. I'm going to take it to like a antique lamp expert someday and they'll fix it. She's like, oh, no, let me look at it. I'm like, Mom, do not touch that lamp. If you lose one little screw on that thing, I can never find a replacement, right? So please do not touch the lamp. She's like, okay. And I come back like 5 minutes later, she's got all the parts of the lamp spread out on the dining room table. I'm about ready to explode. I'm so furious, right? I'm like, okay, I'm just going to walk out of the room before I say something I'm going to regret, right? No lie. I come back like 15 minutes later, she's turning the light on and off and it's working. And I'm like, okay, you're a genius. I give up.
That's awesome. My mother was also a nurse, and she didn't really start working part-time to full-ish time till I went to first grade. And so I was, you know, went early to the neighbor's house because it was the shifts of 6 to 3, 4 to 7, whatever. It was the 8-hour shifts around the clock. And I don't know, I never felt a lot of guilt being a working mom because I felt very loved, and I enjoyed being at other people's houses and hearing their stories and playing with their stuff. And when I came home, my mom was like bossing me around about doing chores. So
you're like, I'm going to go back to the other lady's house. She has cookies.
You know, and I felt very, very loved, and like that I knew my mom as well. But I was just curious to hear your story. I also want to ask you, now you've been married how many years?
Oh, 30 years. Yeah.
And you have had a pretty high stress, high intensity job for how many years? 30?
Yeah, pretty much.
What are your tips for others on staying happily married?
Pick the right guy. I literally found the best guy on the planet. And I don't mean to disparage every other great husband out there, but I mean, he's just been my rock. And for example, he was the person who was with my daughter when I was away. And so they have a very close relationship too. And it's really special to see. As a matter of fact, it started early when we were in Bahrain. I remember he couldn't work because he's a physical therapy assistant, but they use doctors over there. So he couldn't work in Bahrain. So he took care of my daughter when she was born. And I will never forget, I came home after, she's about a year old, and she's sitting in her high chair and she was throwing food on the floor. And, you know, my big thing, discipline thing with her was just shaking my finger in her face and saying no, right? And she bust out crying because she's just that kind of kid, right? You know, but anyway, so she's throwing food on the floor. And so I shook my finger in her face. I said no. And she put her finger back at me and shook it back at me and then looked at my husband and they both started laughing. And I'm like, whoa. I go, what just happened there? He's like, yeah, we kind of make fun of that when you're not around. I'm like, babe, she's won. I'm like, we got to be together on this discipline thing. You're killing me. You're killing me. So they've been really tight ever since. And, you know, they just went on a hiking trip in Shenandoah a couple weeks ago. I mean, so it's just a wonderful relationship and he's a wonderful guy. And I could not have ever done it without him. I mean, it's a partnership and the military truly is service for everybody in your family too, because they are just as much engaged as you are. And I was always very honest with my daughter about when I could be there and when I couldn't. But the one time I didn't tell her, when I went to Iraq, I didn't tell her I was going to Iraq because I knew, I just told her I was deploying basically. And she thought it was on a ship. And I let her believe that for a little bit, which I felt a little guilty about. But I also knew she knew I was in Iraq because it was at the beginning of the war. And there was a lot of news about people getting killed and all that kind of stuff that would have been really, really difficult for her to. She was only 8. And so I made the choice then that we would not say where exactly I was.
And how often were you able to communicate with your family when you were deployed? What was the communication style or available to you?
Letter writing and phone calls. You could basically do a phone call back once a day. But as things progressed, it became way easier. You could pick up the phone. You know, my last tour on a carrier, you know, you could pick up the phone at any time you needed to and call back home if the satellite connection was up. And, you know, you're not going to chat for 4 hours or anything, but just do a check-in with home. And then, of course, email and things like that. You can't video conference just because the bandwidth doesn't support that.
So does she have a box of letters from you or you have a box of letters from her?
Yeah, both. Yeah, she does. And I used to send her postcards from everywhere I was. And I would actually, when I was underway on the ship, I would send her a letter a day. So she knew she would get a letter every day from me. And I also had pre-done about 180 little notes that her father would put in her lunchbox every day. And so she'd have a little note from mom in her lunchbox. And then I would do things like read Harry Potter book on tape. And so she could listen to my voice, you know, on tape. And so you just do things to stay connected that way. And it's important to think about it before you're gone on the deployment and have it sort of in place and rolling so that they know you're always on their mind.
And where is your daughter today?
She's actually a professional ballerina and she's in Virginia. Being a military kid, you get dragged all over the world and stuff like that. But that was one thing she started when she was 2.5. And believe me, I don't know where she got this because she was like, mommy, I want to dance. Mommy, I want to dance. And I don't know if you've ever seen Best in Show, that guy has like 2 left feet. That's totally me. So I don't know where she got this from, but she was relentless. And so we found a place, even when she was 2.5, to go and start ballet. And it was just jumping around and stuff. And the lady's like, hey, we don't take them till they're 3. I'm like, please, for the love of God, take my kid. She's driving crazy, right? But she never looked back. That's all she ever wanted to do. So when she was 16, she got her first ballet contract with a company. And we let her graduate from high school early and go off and do that. But growing up, we would always make sure that I was either stationed in a place where she could get really good training or we could send her where she could get her training that she loved. And so her dream was just as important as mine and my husband. So there's ways in families to manage that, but it takes effort, takes some coordination and stuff like that. But, you know, you can't be solely focused on your career yourself. You got to make sure that everybody else's dreams and aspirations are just as important as yours and taken care of.
You said she's a scientist as well?
Ballerinas can have a short shelf life. If they get an injury, they're done. It's sort of like athletes and things like that. So I said, hey, you need to make sure you have some sort of backup plan. She's like, well, I do want to go to college, but you know, with my ballet schedule, dancing all day, it's really hard. I said, well, why don't you go ahead and apply for school? So she went to University of Kentucky and she actually got her degree. It took her about 5 years and she had moved on to other ballet companies after that and was able to finish up. But she got a bachelor's of science degree. So I call her my scientist in a tutu. And I think that's important because like kids, sometimes they get the message like, hey, you can do the arts or you can be a STEM kid. You know, you can do science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But I'm like, no, you can do all those things. You can be many things. Just exposing kids to stuff and letting them run is good.
In electrical engineering and in computer science, there is this myth and stereotype pushed of just being so deep in just those two arenas and that you can't exist with other elements. And I wonder if that's what turns women away from pursuing it as a college degree, because you still have other very difficult programs with mathematics, like their medicine is graduating at number of medical doctors, but still there's this weakness there. And I think that especially the future of computing is very interdisciplinary. And I'm sure your experience of even working together on these extremely complex communication systems or impacting the future state of the Navy's cyber infrastructure involves lots and lots of people with different policies that come into play, right? It's not a pure tech stack issue.
Yeah, you are spot on. And I will tell you that being a history major, I can actually write pretty decently, right? And I find that a lot of people who just do tech can write tech, but they can't write very well. And as you advance in an organization, people expect you to be able to write strategically and do those kind of things. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is like there's a lot of human machine interface things that if it's just a tech person developing it, they may not have all the perspective that someone who's an anthropologist or somebody who's not, you know, is in human design or artistic design can help with.
And they're not ever typically the user. I think that's maybe one of the differences in the commercial world is oftentimes in commercial, you're developing something that you, your grandma, everyone can see and use and give feedback on. And in this case, you might be developing something that a very, very small number of users are using. And you may never actually even see it deployed, right? Like you might never actually even see the integrated system and how it works, because even testing some of those environments is very complex.
Yeah. And so understanding the human, you know, the space between the chair and the keyboard, as we say, is like really important. What is that human going to interact with that machine in a way and to get to singularity where they eventually merge completely, that you're going to have people who can bridge that gap. And if I can give you an example, like even when it comes to artificial intelligence, you know, they say, hey, it matters where your artificial intelligence went to school, right? And what your background is, because there's an example of a language translation thing that happened where in Turkish, they use the same pronoun for male and female, right? So they were translating a sentence that said, John is a nurse, from English to Turkish and from Turkish back to English. And so going in, it said, John is a nurse, and translated that into Turkish. And then coming back, it came back, Joan is a nurse. Because obviously, John's a guy, he can't be a nurse. Well, how does that happen? The guy who wrote the algorithm for the AI or the gal had a bias about who could be a nurse, what gender could be a nurse, right? And so even the things like the AI, it is impacted by people who can culturally understand the personal side, not the technical side.
I have noticed that you wear like sparkle in your hair. I don't know if it's
sparkle.
You wear a headband every day. What is it that I see in your pictures? Is it a headband? Is it like flare in your hair? What is it?
Well, it is a headband, but it's not a great story because I've had like freakishly thick hair my whole life, like to the point where like I had an afro when I was a kid and people are like, oh my God, that kid's hair is crazy freakish. Recently, in the last 6 months, my hair was falling out in droves, like handfuls, because of some medication I was on and we finally figured it out. But I like lost 2/3 of my hair. So it just keeps it out of my face and it keeps it like a little more controlled until it grows back.
It's a crown of pearls. I'm looking at your profile picture. It's a beautiful crown of pearls.
Yeah, you know what it is? It's just one of those little hair bands, but it keeps it out of my face. So, yeah.
I love it. You know, the CEO of IBM, Ginni Rometty, she wears headbands all the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I feel like with women, it's hard. You want it to be off your face. You want it to be out of the way. I'm not a bun girl every day. It seems a little severe. So I was curious about your flair, if that was part of your Navy uniform.
my rebelling from having to have my hair up in the Navy uniform for years. No, and actually, honestly, when I first got out, I would have my hair down all the time, which is, like I said, freakishly frizzy. And people would be like, oh, God, you got a lot of hair. You know what I mean? And so I only started putting the other stuff on when it was kind of falling out like crazy, but it'll grow back. So it's all good.
Did you have a long hair and buns too? You and your daughter were doing buns together?
Well, let me tell you, her dad does a mean ballet bun. I mean, I used to get chastised for my crappy ballet buns I would help her with. And then when she learned to do it herself, you know, we were both cut loose. But, and here's my thing too, like, I'm sort of like not really into my hair, you know, like I would wash it and shake it and go. I mean, I don't even brush it a lot of times just because it's so curly and frizzy. So never spent a lot of time on my hair, which anybody who's ever seen it could probably tell you it looks like a hot mess most days.
But did you get like headaches from the buns?
No, it was fine. And it actually just kept it out of your face. Now it's interesting. They've relaxed the restrictions on women and hair in the military, which I think is great. It used to be like, hey, your bun can't exceed 1.5 inches off the back of your head and you can't have any hair bands and you can't have any this or that. And it was really severe. And it was really hard for folks who were maybe African-American or had like me had like frizzy, crazy kind of hair issues, right? Even worse for African-American women who like, you know, they would like to braid their hair, but the braids weren't allowed at a certain point. So they've relaxed all those things. So it's much easier now for military women to serve and have professional looking hair of many different styles. And so that's nice.
Do you have a uniform that you wear now that you're out of the military? Do you like stick with something?
Yeah, like yoga pants and a t-shirt, basically, or cargo pants and my chucks.
What about for board meetings?
If there's no video required at the board meeting, it's Chuck Taylors and cargo shorts. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's different when you got to show up in person. You got to put your game face on, right?
I want to ask you about your book. Now, the title of your book is Rock the Boat. As a natural rebel, I feel like I have unintentionally always rocked the boat and dealt with repercussions of it. So I wondered about your suggestions about rocking the boat and what your experience was like in being someone who does shake things up.
Well, I like to think I'm that person. Sometimes people, you know, get nervous about that or they get intimidated about that. But I think it's actually a good thing. And the book is Rock the Boat, Embrace Change, Encourage Innovation, and Be a Successful Leader. Because I do believe, you know, as a leader, you have to look for those opportunities that are transformational, that will change something for the better, the mission, the people, and the business of your business, right? And if you don't look to those opportunities to change things, then you might be successful for a while, but you know, you don't want to be end up being Sears in an Amazon world. Years ago, Sears was the biggest employer in the whole United States, and they had the catalog thing and, you know, all that
stuff.
They had the
car repair. My dad gave me a Craftsman toolbox when I graduated from college so that I could repair things by myself. Yeah.
Quickly, they didn't realize or didn't see fast enough what was happening in the digital world and what was happening in opportunities there and the convergence of transformations on logistics and manufacturing and selling and the internet. And because they didn't see that or seize that opportunity, Amazon ate their lunch, right? And so as a leader, you have to really be looking forward and for vision and where are those kind of convergent points. And if you look at the autonomous vehicle, you know, Uber and Lyft and those ride services, if you look at them individually, they're all transformational. They've all had big impacts in their industries, right? But if you combine them together, that's true transformation. You know, now I'm going to step out of my house 2, 3, 4 years from now, not too far in the future. And there's going to be something that shows up at my house. It's going to be a little hovercraft. It's going to be a car of some kind with no driver in it. It's going to scan the RFID tag in my forehead or in my hand. It's going to charge my bank $2 and it's going to take me to work. That's transformational. You know, what that means is kids born today will never learn how to drive a car. They'll never own a car. There won't be Pep Boys or car dealerships the way we know them or, you know, car rental companies, any of that stuff. You know, so as a leader, what are those transformational points for your organization or your business or whatever it is you're doing that will become really, really impactful for a whole industry potentially?
Now, how do you come across with your good or right idea, but not come across like that crazy person in the corner? What is the tipping point or essence to get others to believe in you and act on that future vision and start to prepare for that evolution?
Well, they have to see their part in it. They have to see where it is you're going. So you have to be able to communicate that in language that they understand. So you can't talk geek speak, you know, like in the tech world, I call it dolphin speak, you know, we speak, hey, look, what about this router? You know, you got the nerd thing going on, right? No, I mean, you have to put it in terms that mean something to them. And how do they understand their role in it and how it's going to change their life or how it's going to make their job easier, better, smarter, faster, or their contributions can be included. And so you have to really put it in terms that they can understand. And so that takes a lot of communication skills that are not necessarily inherent in a tech community that sometimes has a difficulty communicating the benefits of the technology to others. And then the last thing I'll say is look to people who do this really well, like Elon Musk and some of those folks, are true visionaries who have found those transformational points, right? And some people say, oh, they're crazy or whatever. And, you know, they probably get called that all the time, but that's okay, right? Because people will eventually figure out what they're doing and get aboard. I mean, look at Walt Disney. I consider him an inspiration for me. He looked at swampland in Florida. Can you imagine what Orlando looked like before Disney, right? He shows up down there. It's the swampland. And he sees flying elephants with kids riding on them with their parents laughing joyously. And then he makes that a reality. That's true visionary right there. People who can translate it to reality.
So it's not being really great at an OV1.
Exactly. Very good. Good point. That's right. You just made me tear up a little there. I'm really proud of you. That's awesome.
You know, in the architecture world, they do 3D models of buildings, right? So people can walk around and get a sense of how it integrates into the landscape. And often with these systems, we don't do those mock-ups and we don't really lead with having a whole clickable prototype of what it looks like from the end user's perspective. But there's so much that can be done to allow not the visionaries, but those early secondary adopters to come on board and to start seeing it and to start seeing the map from A to B. I think a lot of people can understand the vision, but they don't understand. And I think what Elon Musk did was he didn't even start the company, but he brought that energy and that passion. And then, as you know, that urgency. I think that's why there's so much innovation that happens in war, right? Because that absolute mission critical is there. And that's why cybersecurity is so hot, because our adversaries are not stopping and they're trying all the platforms and all the things and using it. So have you gotten into a bit of the social engineering and the social aspects of how those communication systems are impacting cybersecurity and I guess security overall?
The whole cybersecurity thing is very daunting and it's scary to people and it's very unknown. And honestly, it's a real cat and mouse game. You're never going to have an impenetrable network. You're never going to have complete cybersecurity. So don't,
what?
That shouldn't be your goal. Yeah, exactly.
What?
I mean, that's a hard lesson. It's a hard lesson for folks.
I'm aiming for 100%.
I know. You need to be like Ted Kaczynski and have that phone that's not connected to anything, right? Not even to your cellular tower. But the issue is that you just have to be resilient in a world that is digital, because it has, again, both opportunity and risk. Your data, for example, are out there. You can't stop that now. That horse is out of the barn. So people think, hey, I'm going to make sure no one gets my social security number or whatever. It's too late. What you can do is be smarter about it, make yourself a harder target than somebody else, and protect it the best you can. And then when it is compromised, then, you know, you deal with it then through technology that can help you with that, frankly. But even when you don't put stuff out, like I don't put my birth date out there and stuff, but it's out there. You know, last year when I turned 53, the first email I got that day was from some company that said, here's a recommendation on the best toenail clippers for seniors. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you serious? That's the email I get that day, right? I'm like,
did it have a long handle so you didn't have to bend down so far?
Yeah, it was awful, you know? So, I mean, so the big data is out there, right? And so you're not going to stop that, but you have to live in this world, and this is the world we live in. And so you just have to be comfortable with it. You have to be comfortable with, there's some risk there, but there's tons of opportunity. Think of things that just being able, you and I, to have this talk today. You know?
I know. It's amazing.
20 years ago, this would have never happened, right?
Or even the fact that we met.
Absolutely. Because I wouldn't have bumped into you in a bar probably or whatever. You know what I mean? There's incredible opportunity, but you just have to be okay with that and manage it.
Jumping back to the book, tell me about the writing process. How did it come about that you wanted to write a book?
Well, it was interesting because I didn't really ever like say, oh, geez, I want to be a published author, right? It kind of more morphed out of, I used to do a lot of mentoring talks with groups and things like that. Just as a Navy officer, you do that in general. You'll speak to different groups of people, large or small, about mentoring topics, you know, like, how do you deal with a jerky boss, or what's your work-life balance issues, or how do you motivate people, or how do you communicate? Just kind of common sensey kind of things. The same questions would come up again and again and again and again and again, right? And so I'm like, you know, I'm just going to write these down because hopefully someone can learn something from them. And so the process of the writing the book, you know, some days I'd be totally lazy. I wouldn't want to do it. And it was just like painful. I was like, oh gosh, I don't want to deal with that today, right? And I remember I was speaking at a conference, South by Southwest, and I was in the really nerdy little offshoot room with, you know, maybe two people in it listening to me talk about precision navigation and timing. Well, that's a real barn burner right there, right? But after that ended, Neil Gaiman was speaking in one of the big rooms, and Neil Gaiman wrote Graveyard Stories and Stranger Things and things like that. So I was like, oh, I really want to go listen to him talk. And somebody in the audience asked him, they're like, hey, you know, what do you do when you get writer's block? Do you ever get writer's block? And he's like, just sit down and write, just do the work. And so I kind of remember that. I'm like, okay, Danelle, stop whining about it. Just sit down and write and do the work. And so I did. And before you know it, you're done. And then you go through a bunch of edits, which are kind of painful because it's your baby and you want to make sure that your tone and your voice still stay the same. But my publishers were great. And so I'm just hoping that it resonates with folks in a common sensey way. And again, it's not a book that's going to kill your brain cells. I mean, it's got pictures in it. And like I talked about my saint of a husband, right? We talk about, you know, getting your tongue stuck in the keyboard. He actually posed for a picture that's in the book where he's got his tongue stuck in the keyboard. So it's not meant to be War and Peace. It's just meant to be like a conversation, a fun, good, interesting conversation that you can actually take practical advice from and put into action.
How long did it take you to write it from start to finish?
It was last year when the pandemic started. I had like some little notes, like maybe 2 pages of notes of things that I wanted to make sure I hit in the book. And then when I started writing, I just chunked it out, and it probably took me about 2 months.
So were you writing like 4 hours a day?
It depended. You know, I would go in, write, and if I got on a tear, I'd write for a while. And then if it was like struggling, I'd just write for, you know, 20 minutes, put it down and come back the next day. So it kind of just depended what my mood was that day.
How did it feel to finish it?
Like birthing a baby. I'm like, get that thing off my plate. I'm done. We're on to the next thing, right? Then it became, I'll tell you, I didn't know anything about the publishing industry. I was kind of naive. I was like, yeah, I'll write a book. I'll send it to 100 publishers. I'll probably get like 99 no's. All I need is one yes, right? Well, that's not how it works for nonfiction. You got to have a book proposal and this and that. And, you know, they want to rewrite 50% of your book. So you really have to find someone who will allow you the things that you want. And in my case, it was, you know, I wanted to have creative control over the book. Like I didn't want to change my tone, for example, because I want it to be not a heavy book to read. I want it to be an enjoyable book to read. I do not enjoy leadership books where they put like, you know, mathematical formulas in there for gravitas. And I'm like, you know, that just makes my head want to explode. I just want some practical advice that I can actually go and use today, right? So that's kind of where I wanted to make sure that tone remained and that was what the final book would be. And it is. So I was really pleased with that.
Why did you decide to go with a publisher versus self-publishing?
Well, because again, I found pretty quickly that I know jack about the publishing industry and I know nothing about how to get books distributed and how to get ICBN numbers and how to get it on Amazon and how to market it and how to get it printed and how to warehouse. I mean, all the mechanics of books. And plus, you know, I went through 4 edits, right? And so they'll find grammar mistakes because even though I'm a history major, my grammar's still jacked up, right? You know, and so they'll find grammar mistakes or, you know, things that they'll be like, you know, this didn't really flow right, or I didn't get what you were saying here. Can you rewrite this a little bit clearer or whatever? So they really provided good advice on that kind of stuff. And plus they help with design of the cover and things like that, which, you know, they had a whole team of folks that do those kind of things. So I was really appreciative of all the work that Greenleaf Press did to help with, you know, the mechanics of the book stuff.
I was doing my research on you, and you have a ping pong table where your dining room table typically.
Hell yeah. Who doesn't have that, right?
I find ping pong super hard. How did you come to be an amazing ping pong player?
Oh, I'm not amazing, actually. And it's hilarious because me and my husband are both equally awful at it. But we're awful at the same level. So when we're walking by the table and I'll be like, hey, you want to get your butt kicked? You want to bring it? You know, bring your game. He's like, yeah, you bring it, you know? And so we have this fake ping pong rivalry in the house, you know, Mike Tyson style. Nobody's getting an ear chewed off, but it's pretty intense. I'm not a formal person and I just am who I am. And he is the same way too. He's way laid back, you know? And so, and we said, you know, when are we ever going to do formal dining? Never. And so I said, you know, let's get a ping pong table because It's so funny. I have people over for dinner and, you know, they'll be like three-star admirals or, you know, other friends and things like that. And I had one guy actually bring his own ping pong paddle. He was so excited about having the table there, right? And everybody's demeanor changes. The minute you put a ping pong paddle in someone's hand, it's sort of like putting a bubble wand in somebody's hand, you know, blowing bubbles. Their demeanor immediately changes and they just have fun, you know? And so it's just a fun thing to do. And so, yeah, it's just fun.
Anything ever broken from playing ping pong?
Feelings, you know, hearts are broken. You know, my husband's heart's broken every time I beat him. You know, it's just how it is. He's going to have to live with it. No, nothing broken yet. No broken bones. It's not a high impact sport in our house. Like no one's dodging to the floor. We're not, you know, Chinese quality, high level, you know, standing 30 feet back, you know, from the table kind of thing. We're basically just barely keeping up.
My favorite is air hockey. I love a real air hockey table, but you can get those fingers really whacked. And are you a piano player too? I saw the piano in the background.
No, the funny story about that is, you know how you expose your kids to everything, right? And so my daughter at one point wanted to take piano lessons. So we signed her up for some piano lessons. And then the teacher's like, hey, you do need to get her like a keyboard or something she can practice on. We had to practice on like a piece of paper with piano keys written on it, right? And so I was looking at buying like those electronic keyboards. And then I was in Salvation Army of all places dropping some stuff off. And I saw this piano in there. I'm like, how much is that piano? It was less than the keyboard. So I'm like, that's a cool antique. I said, I'm going to get that. Even though it's never been in tune and the kids just pound on it. And she gave up on piano, like, I don't know, 4 months after she started. Right. But we've always kept the piano because it's a beautiful antique.
It looks like you have a historic house. How old is your house?
The house is about 90 years old, probably, and it's a beautiful home. We're really fortunate to have it. It is very old, but it's nice because it's got like the old glass wavy windows in the front.
I love books and I love reading. So tell me, outside of the book that you wrote, what is a favorite book that's had a big impact on you?
You know, I like A Bell for a Donno. I know that's an old book, a Pulitzer Prize winner. And I like All the Light We Cannot See recently, in the last couple of years. That's a great book. The ones that resonate most with me are sort of the classics. You know, when I read, I don't read a lot of management books or leadership books, frankly. I mean, I find them kind of boring. I like a good story. And so I read novels, something that it's got a story that's going to resonate or surprise me or whatever. And so I've found that a lot of the older books, you know, even Jane Austen and those are just good stories. You know, I love Far From the Madding Crowd, you know, Hardy. And I just think that there's a lot of really good stories out there that are timeless, and I like to read those.
Is there a book that you recommend to people when they come to you for mentorship before you publish yours?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there's one I used to give, actually, to all the people I'd mentor until that number got to be like too big. You know what I mean? But I used to give it to a lot of the people I mentor. It's called Lincoln on Leadership. And I just found it, again, to be a practical, really good book. And it's not real long, but it's a great, great read.
Is there anything going back you wish you did differently?
Yeah, I can be really impatient. And that translates into some bad behavior sometimes, like interrupting or, you know, assuming that people can work at the pace that I might work something at or that I want done. And sometimes you just got to take a step back, take a breath and let people work at their pace, let them talk at their pace, let them think at their pace. And, you know, they're not you. And so don't project you onto them and, you know, why aren't you doing it this way or whatever. So I think if I had to go back, I wish I had been smarter about being more patient with people, maybe, and maybe a little more attuned to the speed, I guess, or the capacity that people have. Because it's one thing to push people to give them stretch goals, right? It's another thing to push them over the edge where they feel like just constantly that they're underperforming at work. And you don't want people to feel like that. You know what I mean? You want them to feel like, hey, I didn't think I could do that. I'm going to try to do that. And oh, look, I just did that. That's so awesome. Not like, oh my God, there's no way I can never do this. I hate going to work. It's awful. There's a fine line between there. And I didn't always know where that line was. And I think, you know, I could have done better at that.
What should I have asked you that I didn't ask?
You know, like what's the fastest land mammal? I don't even know, but you know.
I think it's either a jaguar or a greyhound because my son tells me.
Okay, there you go. So you know, you got the answer, right?
I'll put the true one in the show notes. And finally, tell me something about yourself that might surprise others.
I used to work in the Haunted Mansion at Disney World.
Were you a scary person? What was your job?
I'm always scary. If you ask people to work for me, I'm like a witch even to this day. You know, the broom has followed me, you know? Yeah, I used to do that in college. Again, I love Walt Disney. I find him an inspiration. I used to actually have his picture hanging in my office where people would have like military John Paul Jones or military pictures. I always had Walt Disney in my office. You know what I mean? Yeah, so when I was in college, I was like, hey, I'm just going to go work in Disney World in the summer. And I did with some friends of mine. We went down, got jobs. And the first year we worked in, we call it the weenie wagon, the hot dog cart at Epcot Center. And then the second year I got my dream job and got transferred over to the Haunted Mansion. And you just help people through the ride. It's like what you see them doing there. You know, you manage the queue, help them on the ride and all that kind of stuff. But it was a blast. I loved it.
So you have a very funny mom moment where you mortified your daughter in front of her friends.
Pretty much. That's kind of, you know, if you're a teenager, anything your parents are doing is mortifying. You know, that's a common theme, right? So this is a story I tell in the book. It's sort of about like you need to be forgiving of yourself of mistakes and forgiving of others, right? If you don't forgive yourself on stuff, you're never going to be the kind of person who's recognizing enough that you need to forgive others, right? My daughter was probably like 14 or 15 and she was having a slumber party. She had like four girls over and, you know, they had like pretty much exhausted all the things that 14-year-old girls do, like making like unrecognizable food in the kitchen with lots of sugar and butter. And then, you know, my husband would subsequently be the guinea pig to eat it, right? So they're sitting on the couch and they're just basically texting each other on the couch. You know how teenagers are, right? And I'm like, hey, let's play a game or let's watch a movie. I said, hey, how about we watch some home movies? And hey, my daughter was like, oh, mom, no, no, no. And I'm like, yeah. I said, let's watch the naked baby video. And she's like, oh, no, no. And her friends are like, oh, yeah, we want to see that, right? And it was just a video of when she was a kid. And she finally acquiesced. She's like, okay, all right. So we pop it in and we start watching it. And we were, is the video is that we were on a cruise and we were going to go swimming. She's probably about 2 years old at the time, right? 18 months, 2 years old. So we were going to put her bathing suit on and take her up to the pool, go swimming. We were all going to go swimming together. And so we go to our room and we're getting her bathing suit on. Before we could get her bathing suit on, she starts running around. You know how kids without a stitch of clothes on think they just like, it's the greatest thing in the world to be naked and running around. So she's running around, joyous peals of laughter as we try to fake catch her and we don't get her. And she just keeps running around. And I'm like, I'm going to videotape this. This is so cute. So I'm videotaping her doing this. And it was just a really sweet, fun moment, right? We finally went to the pool and that was all was good. And so like 15 years later, we're watching this video and my daughter turns to me while the video is going and she's like, mom, you're naked. And I go, what? I go, no, 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 you're naked, naked baby. Look at you running around. She's like, look in the mirror. So sure enough, there in the video, in the back of the video is this big mirror, floor to ceiling mirror, right?
Were you like 100% naked?
100%, 100% girl. And there I am wearing nothing but the video camera, right? And so I got this like huge video camera, like, you know, the old TV crews used to be in the day, right? This big video camera on my shoulder, right? And there I am buck naked, right? And I was like, oh my God, right? I'm like, how many copies of this video have I given to like relatives and friends? And I can just imagine them sitting on their couch being like, oh my God.
No one ever told you?
Just sent. No one ever said a word. But, you know, I say out of that, like even the most cringeworthy thing, you find three positive things out of every really bad situation. So in that case, my three positives were that I actually had a six pack, or at least I could recognize one ab without deep faking it in that video, right? So there's like one ab there. I could probably get back into fighting shape, right? It was the time before videos, TikTok videos and stuff. So it's not going to be on the internet, you know, naked Admiral video, right? And then the other thing was, it was just that I've recorded my daughter at 2 years old with joyous peals of laughter, which to me is just, it's priceless. So no matter how cringeworthy the rest of it was, I will always have that.
Well, now you can edit the video size.
That's right. Put a hot bikini on myself, right?
Oh, that's true too. But you can also just cut that portion of the video.
I probably should. You're right.
Well, thank you so much for being part of this and sharing your story with others. Where can we get the book?
You can pre-order the book on Amazon now, and the audio version will be available in June on Amazon as well.
We can't wait. We can't wait to read it. This summer, perfect reading by the pool. Hopefully we're all getting back, maybe doing some travel.
And wearing a bathing suit, right?
Yeah.
Don't be naked. That's right.
Depends on where you are and how you live. Right. But thank you so much for being a fearless leader in the field and serving the country for so long and making such an impact on so many lives. I think it's really incredible and an honor to get to share this time with you. So thank you for sharing yourself with others.
Thank you for having me. It has been a real honor to talk to you and just a privilege. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.